ऐसी मशीन लगाऊंगा, इस साइड से आलू घुसेगा, उस साइड से सोना निकलेगा।
Hello everyone, welcome to this episode of the Attention Please podcast. This is your host Arnab Bray, and today we'll be talking about the US troop withdrawal in Afghanistan and pictures. Who owns your pictures? So first of all, Afghanistan. So as you, those of you who follow the news, which I'm guessing is everyone who is listening to this podcast, the Biden administration has announced its irrevocable and final decision to withdraw all US troops from Afghanistan. And this is obviously a fairly significant event for those who follow Indian politics and the larger geopolitics of this region, because of course we are in the neighborhood of this foreign policy decision, and Pakistan is well invested in the conflict in Afghanistan, has been well invested in it for a long time. This was, in a way, inevitable. As I think any long-form article of Afghanistan always has a reference to a supposed Afghani proverb, which says, "You got the clock, we have the time." So, in a way, there is no end game ever in Afghanistan. It has never been possible for any of the colonial Western powers to gain their strategic objectives in Afghanistan, because all that the local population, the local fighters need to do is they need to bide out time. And I think, and we'll talk about in a little bit depth about this, so I'm kind of bearing the lead by talking about this. But before we get into why the US got in, the simple answer is, of course, 9/11. It's important for the listener to understand briefly the history of why Afghanistan became important for the Americans. So Afghanistan actually was not important for the Americans for a long time. And that's because the Americans had a very good ally in the Shah of Iran. So the Shah of Iran, and this was in the days of the Cold War, so the Shah of Iran was essentially a U.S. stooge. And in return for propping up the Shah's regime, the Shah basically allowed the CIA a free hand in Iran. And again, as long as they did not undermine the Shah's authority, the Shah was fine. And the reason why the U.S. considered the Iran to be such a strategic ally was because in those days, this is pre-internet, they needed listening posts as to what the Russians were talking about in terms of their radio communication. And Iran was the closest listening post that they had. You have to remember that the Iron Curtain, the USSR, the erstwhile USSR, had created a huge buffer for them in Europe. So there was really no way that the Americans could get to the Russians. And the Russians knew that. And so Iran was the closest that they could get to the Russians. So they had a listening, they had multiple listening posts, and there was some activity, some CIA activity with respect to USSR, quite significant going through Iran at that point of time. And then all of this changed when the Iranian Revolution happened and the Ayatollah Khomeini took over. And they basically barricaded the U.S. embassy. The U.S. embassy employees were held hostage. So it was a massive loss of face for the U.S. And it just showed that the U.S. were just not welcome and would not be welcome in Iran for a long time to come. And the Ayatollahs and their whole Islamic priestly, the Shia, that was when the rise of Shia power in the region. And it's very important to understand the distinction between Shia power and Sunni power, specifically when we're talking about Afghanistan and we're talking about that region. And sometimes many discussions, the distinction is often papered over, usually because people don't understand it and they say Islamic powered, but no, there's two Islams and they're not, and they've rarely collaborated, and they're each of them would consider the other to be their biggest enemy. So it's very important, with some exceptions. So it's very important that we understand that this was the growth of Shia power in Iran. Now, what happened because of that was that the Americans immediately began to eye Afghanistan, which was essentially a country only in name. It has always been a country only in name. It was essentially pockets of power, some place where the central administration held power. Most places it was tribes that held power. So the Americans tried to move in to Afghanistan at that point of time, or they were thinking of moving into Afghanistan to establish their listening posts. And that when the USSR basically preemptively struck there and they rolled their military into Afghanistan and tried to invade Afghanistan. And principally the reason is there's no oil in Afghanistan. There's no other importance for Afghanistan vis-a-vis the Cold War, except that they just didn't want the US to get a listening post. So they wanted Afghanistan to then form a part of the, similar to the buffer that they had in Eastern Europe. So they knew that the Americans couldn't get into Iran. If they get Afghanistan, then they have a significant buffer against the Americans. The Americans won't be able to get close to their communications. The Russians, of course, as those of you who follow history would, or even like read newspapers, you don't have to be a historian to know this, is that the Russians also didn't fare well in Afghanistan. And one of the reasons that are offered for the fall of the USSR, among many, was it was the military misadventure that Afghanistan turned out to be. And one of the reasons why it turned out to be a misadventure was that Americans were successful in creating, based on their own resources, groups of fighters that were that rebelled against the Russians. So the Americans could not engage the Russians because of fears of World War III directly. So they fought it through proxies. And the proxies, and again, I'd covered this in a podcast a long time ago, but I'll still go over it. So at that point of time, they were arming the tribes, but they still needed some fabric to bind the tribes together to fight the Russians. I don't think that just saying that we want a listening post here was going to inspire people to die. That was when they decided to import into Afghanistan, something which kind of had never been there in Afghanistan before. So if you see pictures of women in skirts walking in Kabul, this was not something which was inherently there. It was imported at that point of time, Islamic, hardcore Islamic fundamentalism, and the US imported it in order to provide that fabric to unite the warring factions that we are fighting under the flag of Islam. And in order to do that, in order to get these people to fight, there was just no Afghani leader who was going to stand and take the flag, because they were all divided based on tribes. That the tribal aspect is extremely strong in that region. So what they did was the US, they created a camp where they started training these Afghani rebels. And in order to run the camp, they imported from other places leadership. One of their imports was a member of the Saudi royal family who was considered to be too radical even by them, a man by the name of Osama bin Laden. And the other place where they looked was to Egypt, which was also an ally/vassal of the US, in the sense that the US were paying them a lot of money, essentially paying their government a lot of money. And so what they did was they cleaned their jail out of Islamic dissidents and send them all over to Afghanistan to fight the jihad or the holy war. And the camp where they were based out of, the name of that camp in, I think, Arabic is the base camp. And the word is Al-Qaeda. So that's when Al-Qaeda started. So Al-Qaeda, and this is important to understand, Al-Qaeda is not native to Afghanistan at all. Al-Qaeda is essentially a foreign philosophical input, which was brought in by the US, and of course, we all know how that ended, to fight the Russians. Osama bin Laden had absolutely no connection to Afghanistan. They were basically using it as a base for their holy war. So this was not related. But of course, the people that they drew were from that region. So Islamic fundamentalism started to rise. It was deliberately allowed to rise at that point of time. And the money that drove the ascension of Islamic fundamentalism was to an extent provided by the US. And this is, again, not an accusation. This is well known and part of recorded history at this point of time. Now, as Islamic fundamentalism grew, then the Taliban started to rise, which were, again, the Taliban was different from Al-Qaeda. It has always been. So Taliban is actually the part of, so once you have Islamic fundamentalism, once you import something, there are many people who find it absolutely attractive and very, very inspiring. But the Taliban were not interested per se in fighting a war in Iraq or later on. And again, the war in Iraq, again, this would be a long diversion, but after the war in Afghanistan ended, and Saddam and the Saudi princes fell out, and Saddam decided to invade Kuwait because he felt that the Saudis owed him money because he basically fought their proxy war against Iran for him. So he said, well, give me money. And the Saudis said, too bad, you lost the war. I mean, you were supposed to win it. You did nothing. Yeah, it was kind of a stalemate, so we're not paying you. So he said, all right, you're not going to pay me. I'm going to take your oil fields. So that's really how the first Iraq war started. And at that point of time, it was Osama who went and talked to the Saudi princess and said, don't invite the Americans, don't invite the non-believers into our holy lands. I will fight Saddam for you. Because Saddam was a kind of not an Islamic believer. He was like, in that region, he's like a left liberal, believe it or not. So there was no love lost between Osama and Saddam, which is why when George Bush's administration went and said that Saddam and Al-Qaeda and Osama had collaborated together for 9/11, it was so hilarious. It was like the last thing that would ever happen because they hated each other. And of course, nobody in the US much knew, nobody really cared to find out that this was an impossibility. And anyways, that's another thing. But the point that I'm trying to say is that Al-Qaeda and the Taliban are different. So, which brings us to, why did the US enter the war? Well, it's very clear now, based on papers that were revealed by Washington Post, that the US had no clear objective with respect to the war in Afghanistan. There was no clear objective. It was done at that point of time as a way of showing that the US was not weak. They had been attacked, so we needed to go and, you know, kick some ass. So they decided to go into Afghanistan. So again, the publicly stated objectives at that point of time was that US was under threat from Al-Qaeda, and so they needed to decimate the organization of Al-Qaeda. And they first asked the Taliban government to hand over Osama and Mullah Omar, who was the head of the Taliban, basically flipped US the middle finger. So the US essentially extended the war from Al-Qaeda to Taliban. This was, again, the US were not at war with the Taliban initially. As a matter of fact, before 9/11, the representatives of Taliban had visited the US. So the US had absolutely no problem with the radical anti-woman, anti-non-believer crazy, mad regime of the Taliban's before that. It was only when the Taliban refused to hand over Osama bin Laden that the scope of America's enemies was extended from Al-Qaeda to the Taliban. And so what the presumption was that America was going to go in, they were going to kill bin Laden, they were going to destroy Al-Qaeda, and then they were going to establish democracy and modern liberal values. Now, this has kind of been the motive for other wars that America has fought, like World War II. There it was, destroy the Nazis. And it was presumed that whenever you destroy the Nazis, and when so you establish the rule of decency and democracy. So the fundamental presumption over here is that this place, wherever you are putting your troops in, they actually want liberal Western democracy, and they don't want tradition, and that there is some extraneous force, some aberration that is basically making this place, quote unquote, evil. This was perfectly correct for the Nazis. And that has been proved by history. Now, the problem with most foreign policy thinking in the West is that it is guided by these, it has been always guided by these fundamental presumptions. And these presumptions don't hold in all places of the world. And unfortunately, because these decisions are usually taken by Western people, usually white men, they don't know. They cannot understand that there are people who do not think like them, that they fundamentally do not think like them, and that they do not have, quote unquote, the white man's burden to change them to, quote unquote, their Western philosophy. This is benign colonialism in a way. Benign as in you would say, well, why is not malignant? Well, there is at least a desire. But if you remember that when the Western forces went into Africa and went into India, they said they were basically going to civilize us at that point of time. So this is, maybe I should not say this, maybe it's not benign at all. Maybe this is the malignancy of the whole colonial project. The fact that some people, some places are different, ergo they're bad. Now, this has always been the extension. This is why they have been there for 20 years. Now, Biden, let's come to Biden. This is important that we take a little sidelight, a detour into Biden. So Biden was always someone who wanted the U.S. to cease engagement in Afghanistan. So, and he was overruled when he was the vice president. And actually, Obama escalated the number of troops in Afghanistan. And that was when they had their biggest casualties. Obama also captured bin Laden, killed him. So then the question became, why are we still there? If we go back to the World War II analogy, well, we just killed Hitler. So everything should be correct right now that we've killed Hitler. And then they found out that, no, that was not true. That presumption, that second presumption was not true. And this was the exact same thing that happened in Iraq. So there's a pattern here. Now, as we talk about Biden basically removing the U.S. from Afghanistan totally, you have to understand that there is not a lot of troops there. It's, I think, 2,500 troops. At one point of time, there was close to 100,000 U.S. troops there. And over the years, and especially under Trump, the U.S. had reduced their engagement in Afghanistan massively. They had stopped funding Pakistan. By the way, we all know Pakistan's great game. 2001, one of the biggest beneficiaries of it was Pakistan, and especially General Pervez Musharraf, who then took money from the U.S. to wage a phony war against Taliban, people that who were treated in Pakistan and who were Pakistani allies. So the war was, friendly fire, and the purpose was that his objective was twofold. One was that he wanted to siphon off the money that was coming from America to fight the war against India. that part to an extent worked. The second part, which didn't work, was to use the Taliban fighters to fight in Kashmir. And that again comes down to the fact that it's not as simple as this global Islamic Jihad thing. It doesn't work like that. Ultimately, when people want to give their lives, they look at their, there are other affiliations which are much stronger. And basically, many of those fighters would be willing to lay down their lives in Kandahar and Kabul, but they won't go to Kashmir because that to them isn't part of their tribal lands. That is not something that they are fighting for. Ultimately, what people die for is trying to protect their kind of life. Good, bad, ugly is just keep it for the side. But why people die and why people have, no other country has ever been able to defeat Afghanistan is because of the tribal nature. First of all, the terrain that is there, but the fact that they fight for their way of life. And Kashmir, you know, this was not part of their way of life. So they were not going to fight that war for Musharraf. And that Musharraf, it took Musharraf some time to realize that that was not going to happen. But he did make a lot of money personally, and he did siphon a lot of money to fight the war in Kashmir, which was, and if you look at like, whether it was a 2008 attack, this was really the time when we were attacked a lot, many times. In India, by Pakistan, and this happened after the US started pouring in billions of dollars into that region, which ultimately a lot of it went to the Pakistanis. So, but the point is again that the US has always in over the years, Trump has whittled down US troop presence in Afghanistan, but there was still a 2,500 skeletal force present. So somebody might ask, well, who cares for 2,500 forces? I mean, what difference would it make? It will, because of the nature of warfare, it's not just the 2,500 troops on the ground. The US were not, for many years, they were not doing like ops. They were not doing operations in the hills. They were not going and clearing out the hills. What they were doing was they were essentially hold and protect. So they were holding and protecting the core Afghani government. And in order to do that, it was just not the troops on the ground. It was their overwhelming military apparatus that they have in terms of their weapons and their air force, their drones, their overall electronic superiority. That is really what is the major US force multiplier. So even when you say there's 2,500 troops on the ground, the fear of the US isn't the fear of 2,500 men. It's not that. It's something much more. And that's why the Taliban, even though they had captured, because the Taliban were always there, they had never really gone away. And they can't, because Taliban is a very, very homegrown Afghani religious fundamentalist organization, but it is absolutely Afghani. It wasn't there before. It was created by Pakistan. It was, as I said, Islamic radicalism combined with nationalism was infused by the Americans as a ploy to fight the Russians. And Taliban was an organization which Pakistan created, but now that's history, that's there. So the Taliban actually can never be defeated in that place because they are from that. Al-Qaeda can be, and they were, because they were flown in from somewhere else and they've all been killed and there are no more people flying in. So there you go. So now that Biden has decided to move out, it's might be the case that the country will fall to the Taliban once again. And when the possibility is being brought up, Biden and the administration are basically shrugging it and saying, well, if that's the way it has to be, then that's the way it will be. And here's the thing, that for the Americans, this makes perfect sense. You see, foreign policy isn't about ethics or isn't about doing the right thing. The only thing that matters in foreign policy is saving your own skin. And when you talk about saving your own skin, any kind of war, any kind of engagement, there has to be a cost-benefit analysis. At this point of time, America's threats are not going to come from Afghanistan. They might come from a digital war launched by, say, China or Russia. There are internal fissures in the US. So in terms of threats to the US, the Taliban and, you know, Islamic radicalism in Afghanistan is a 2000s thing. It doesn't make sense for them anymore. It's like the career of Zayed Khan. It was significant at one point of time, but the time is gone now. So this is, at least in my opinion, a pragmatic decision for the US to take, because the Taliban has no ambitions outside Afghanistan. They're not going to come and attack US. They didn't attack US ever, actually. It was Al-Qaeda which attacked them, and they protected them because, first of all, Islamic camaraderie, and second also that they were also paying them. So the fact is, unless you put that global pan-national jihadi organization, again, is there a risk of another of those coming there? Yes, there definitely is. But right now, the Americans are willing to go with it. And even if one comes, it'll be years before they will have the tactical strength to do anything close to what 9/11 was. So they're saying it's not worth spending the money being there. So in a way, it is a pragmatic decision. Islamic fundamentalism, the global jihad project, again, that follows the works of people like Sayyid Qutb, that's not something which has anything to do with Taliban politics. Taliban politics is essentially establishing an extremely rigid interpretation of Islamic life, which is, as we all know, which is, you know, based on the destruction. There are no minorities left in Afghanistan, of course, but now it's their statues that are left to destroy. But that level of purity, and, you know, a kind of rejection of technology. There's an strong element of being a, you know, the Luddite philosophy. So it's a very specific philosophy that is local to that region. And while people will say, well, what about America's commitment to human rights? What about women's rights? What about America's commitment to minorities in Afghanistan? You know, what really Biden is saying, look, man, it's their choice. We gave them 20 years to do what Europe did after the fall of the Nazis. But Europe chose, Germany chose to walk away from that path. And, you know, these guys haven't. That's their choice. And for me, this is the pragmatic and also the right way of looking at the world. The West needs to understand that not every part of the world is going to follow their path. Not every part of the world has to get with the plan. I remember many years ago, an American friend of me said, oh, you guys drive on the wrong side of the road. And I said, no, we don't drive on the wrong side of the road. We drive on another side of the road. That's all. There's no right or wrong. The fact that you think that you drive on the right side of the road, even though the number of people in India are way more than you, so technically, if we just go by popularity, we drive on the right side of the road and you drive on the wrong side of the road. But I'm not even getting into that. We don't think that we drive on the right side of the road. This is not just not the way we like to think. But from a Western point of view, and because you've internalized this way of looking at countries, which specifically are not Western, you think that you have the right thing and they're doing it the wrong way. Now, I'm not a very combative person, and definitely was not. Most listeners will possibly say, ha, he is. But anyways, when I said this, I was not this combative. It was somewhere in the early 2000s. And this person I said it to was a professor. It was a non-academic setting, but it was a professor. So I was taking a risk there, saying this to him. But to his credit, and that's also part of him being a Westerner, he didn't take it as an affront to his being a professor. If I'd said this in India, I wouldn't have dared to say it in India. But he took it, you know, he took it, yeah, he said, yeah, I get your point, what you're saying. Maybe he didn't say, I'm sorry, but he said, yeah, I get it. I understand what you're trying to say. So that, again, is it's not going to happen in India. It's not going to happen in Afghanistan because, you know, we have to be respectful. But whether it's right or wrong, that who makes the call? And you can say, well, America gets to decide what's right and what's wrong within their shores. They don't get the right to determine what is right and what is wrong on the shores of others. And again, this is a slippery slope. Then you can say, well, does that mean that when genocides happen, the world should not interfere? What should? And there is no good answer to that. But it also has to be balanced by who's going to pay for it. And in this case, in this very specific case, the Afghanistani people have been given 20 years. At least after the death of Osama, they've been given 10 years that if they want, they can totally reject the politics of the Taliban. They can reject the politics of Islamic fundamentalism, but they have chosen not to. They can reject the policies of traditional tribalism. They have chosen not to. And again, this is a choice that they have chosen to live with. It's not a, whether it's a good or bad, it's their choice. And in an age where consent is so important, well, the Americans no longer have the consent. There's no party in Afghanistan which wants the Americans to be there. So why should the Americans be there? So overall, on principle, I personally support the decision taken by Joe Biden. If Joe Biden wants to be truly, truly progressive, then yes, this is the progressive decision. This is the realization that it's both a progressive as well as a pragmatic decision. So again, of course, Elizabeth Warren and all these people will always, I'm going to guess, they're going to be against Biden. But that's a political thing at this point of time. But I don't think what else the Americans could have done, because there's no exit strategy here. There never was an exit strategy here. So which brings me to this other question. Basically, it's kind of a related story, the death of photojournalist Danish Siddiqui. And so there's a lot of controversy on the Indian interwebs regarding the legacy of Danish Siddiqui. Of course, right-wing commentariat were obviously like, this was a person who made his living off, taking pictures of, and he was obviously not, he was not a big fan of the Modi government and of BJP in general. That was fairly obvious. And also he took pictures of, you know, funeral pyres of COVID victims, people who had died from COVID. And there was, at least I saw one tweet where there was a purported picture of his dead body, and one of his supporters was saying, don't sir, first of all, we don't know if it's him, and don't circulate this. This is extremely intrusive to somebody who has passed away. And then, of course, people said, well, what about the intrusiveness into the pictures he took of all these dead bodies? So this is, again, there is no good answer to this. And so I will not claim that, you know, I have a very hard opinion whether it is, but let's just take a look at it. So when we take a picture and we've come to a place in time where I guess we take a lot of pictures, and it's not just a question of a photojournalist, it's we also take a lot of pictures. So who owns the pictures? Who has the right? Again, it comes to consent. Who has the right to, so if you take a picture of yourself, that's perfectly fine because you're both the taker of the picture as well as the subject of the picture. But when you have a subject of the picture who is not yours, who's not you, who's not your family, which you presume has an implied consent, do people have to consent in order to have their pictures taken? Because that is really what the core of this comes to. When you take pictures of dead bodies, or in case of Barkadat, when you are kind of coming into a place where funerals that are going on and kind of shoving your mic into the faces of people and, you know, recording their anger and their grief. And what is the ethics here in terms of who owns that footage? Now, you can say that at that point of time, the person who's venting against the government, against the system, that person is consenting to this because the person clearly sees that he's being recorded. And so ultimately, whether you like it or not, whether you think it's fair or not, whether you think that, you know, the media is now selling it for money or for a Pulitzer, it doesn't really matter. The fact is that both the person holding the camera and the person in front of the camera have the right to do, both have consented to that interaction. It becomes very difficult when the person who's a subject of the camera is not alive, because then there is no notion of consent. So what does it mean? So can you take a picture of a dead body? Is it okay for a journalist to say, I'm a journalist, I can take a picture of a dead body because that's my job? Well, who gave you the job? What gives you the right? So these are questions of ethics that there's no good answers to it. And people on the journalistic side would say, well, it is my job to take it. It is, as somebody who is showing people the truth, as a photojournalist, this is part of fact. This is reality. And I have to show, this is my job to show reality. Some people write and report about the reality that 5 people died. And some people are taking a picture to show, because in today's day and age, you can say 5 people died, some person will come and say, the police will come and say, no, nobody died. It's totally fake news. And given the siloed nature of news and the echo chambers, there's one side which will absolutely refuse to believe that 550, 500, 5,000 people died. It's a lie. Only the one person just needs to say it's a lie. That's it. And the other person will just, see, I told you. So photos are emitted. Again, photos can be manipulated. Videos can be deep faked. So even that is nowadays because of technology. But that's a different question. But the question is, who has the right? For me, at least the way out, I would say, is it depends on the context. So if you are taking a picture of, you post a picture in Facebook of your friend, a number of your friends, where your friends are, you know, captured in an unflattering way, something which I've seen many people do, because they just take pictures of friends in which they look good and the other people not look good. And so at that point of time, do you have the right because you took the picture? And I would say from the context, no. You can post it, but then of course your friends might say, please take that picture down. I don't like that picture of myself. And you should, unless you want to be an asshole, you should take that picture down at that point of time, because being by virtue of being in that picture, so there might be an implicit consent, but when the picture was taken, but now that the picture is out, that person possibly didn't see the finished product. So now that the person's seeing the finished product and that person fairly understands why you posted that picture out of the other 10 that were taken that day in which that person's double chin wasn't showing, that person says, nah, I would really not like you to post that picture. So I again, if you asked me in 2000, when I first got 2002, 2003, when I first got my digital camera, and I wouldn't have even thought in these lines. But nowadays I've evolved, I've seen how people, and I would say, yes, this is the right thing to do, because there is no larger context behind this. But when it comes to taking pictures, as you know, especially of, let's just take as an example, the image of funeral pyres after COVID. Now, of course, a lot of people who support the current government are angry, because they feel that it brings down the nation. It brings down the nation in the eyes of others. And there is no doubt that there is, and that often that I have no doubt that there is a cabal of journalists who are monetizing this both in terms of fame as well as in terms of money. But that, just because they're doing it from, again, whose intent is what, we can never say. But there is a larger context to this, which is why I believe it's beneficial. Because without this, there is no accountability for the government. We will never know. And this comes down to Dr. Amartya Sen's, you know, thesis on why there have been famines in China and not in India, even though we start after independence, even though we kind of started at the same place. It was because that China did not have a free press. It did not have, and India might have had an imperfectly free press, but it was definitely more free than China. So when bad things happened, like the absence of food at any place, the government machinery and the bureaucracy just couldn't suppress that event. The rest of India came to know about Kalahandi. So yes, it would never scale up. There would be, the light would be shown on that place. In China, there is absolutely nothing like that. There is absolutely no press, no free press, no photojournalists, nothing. Everything you see is what the communist government wants. So that's, because of that, one could say, well, that's why nobody gets to, you don't have headlines in New York Times or Washington Post decrying, you know, the pathetic state of public health infrastructure in China. And you don't, you're absolutely right, you don't. And one reason is because there is no information about it. So if there's no information, there is nothing there. But that's not good for the people of China. It definitely isn't. So for me, the notion of pictures and the notion of right to report, especially on disaster and dead bodies, you know, dead body, because that's something very special, because the subject cannot provide consent. There, I think the question that we need to ask with respect to ethics is, what purpose is it serving? What is the larger good of, does that picture by itself, minus the voyeurism and minus the shock effect, is by showing the picture, will something good come out of it? And I think if the answer to it is yes, and of course, people can always say, well, no good came out of it because the government did everything correct. And yeah, there were some mistakes here and there, but they would have rectified it themselves because they're inherently good. That's where, as a centrist, I would always say that I don't buy the fact that a government or an opposition is fundamentally good and will do things just out of the goodness of their heart. People don't do that. Groups don't do that. An individual might do it in some cases, in some situations where they just might do the right thing. But unless they're incentivized or de-incentivized, and that's where a working system exists. The need for a system is to provide a system, of incentives and de-incentives such that the system works in the correct way. So it's independent of the goodness and badness of people. And that's where hard-hitting photojournalism of the kind that Danish Siddiqui did, and again, the kind of reporting that Barkhadab did during COVID times, which is again a catastrophe, once in a century event. That is why I think that, yes, in those cases, an exception can be made. Now, again, the intent, we have to separate out the intent of the individual, which will, I mean, we can comment on it, we can get fun, but we never really know why they're doing it. But the fact is, some good comes out of it. Some good comes out of the shock value of some of these pictures for us to know that this is what is going on. And at this, again, this is where I'll conclude with repeating what the fundamental notion of centrism tells you. For me, the fundamental notion of centrism is, I'm not aligned with the BJP or Congress. I'm not aligned with the ruling party or the opposition. I am aligned with issues and principles. And I like to, that's why the discussions in this podcast are principally of principles. Now, I can't say that I'm always consistent with my principles because I'm a human being myself. I have, first of all, I forget. Second is, sometimes I will not follow my principles because I know why I'm not following the principles. And sometimes I don't follow my principles because I've forgotten or because I'm blindsided, because I'm not seeing the principle. But ultimately, my attempt is always to lay down some principles and follow them and to think about those principles. Again, a fundamentalist is somebody who also has principles, but the thing about a fundamentalist is the fundamentalist doesn't think about his principles, doesn't revisit the presumptions of the principles. The principles are cast in stone, usually based on a book that that person has read, written by somebody usually thousands of years ago. For me, it is important to revisit these principles. So for instance, for these pictures thing, there was a time at which I felt, if I took the picture, it's mine. And again, the question is, what good? And again, when I say pictures, I'm saying purely in the context of violent images of death, injury, grief, that kind of images. And all of us know what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about, a picture of Amisha Patel coming out of the gym during COVID with a mask and giving an interview about her next projects and paparazzi. I'm not talking about that kind of thing. Most listeners will know what I'm talking about. So for me, it's as long as it's in the public good, as long as it's part of what we consider to be the holy grail of journalism, which is to hold governments and bureaucracies and power to account. As long as it's in that service, I think it's okay. Even though, again, I'm not 100%. If you're willing to bet your life on this, no, I don't. I mean, what if the person who's died? I mean, ultimately, you're not taking that person's consent when you're taking that picture. So how can that? And when I start thinking on those lines, I think, well, who decides what the larger context is? And that's when ultimately this is a decision which should ultimately be left to the person whose picture it is and the person who's taking the picture. And so again, there's no way out of that once I start thinking on those lines. But for me, the way out is it in public good? Again, I don't think that I have a hard and fast answer to this. I wish I had. This is again, one of the places where things fall in the gray zone, but it's worth thinking. If for my listeners, I would challenge you to think on these lines. I mean, what do you think? What do you think about this? So that's, and again, the answer to this, there is no right answer to this, because both the answers, you can always challenge them by putting another counterpoint. I totally understand that. So that was the podcast for today. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Again, for those of you who like this podcast, I would once again request you to become a monthly Patreon on my Patreon page. Contributions can be as low as $1 a month, which is not much, $1 a month. And that would be a great way of showing support to the podcast. And again, if you have any questions, you can always email me or, reply to any message on Twitter. I'm on Twitter at GreatBong. I'm guessing everybody who listens to this podcast knows that. That's it. That's the podcast for today. Have a safe week. Bye-bye.